Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Survival Podcast. Today is Monday, and it is May the 13th, 2024. And today we're going to talk about composting with worms. We have discussed this in the past. However, we've always discussed it as part of another thing. So we've discussed it, for instance, when we've talked about composting in general. We've talked about this as a method of composting and given a basic overview of it. We've talked about it as a function stacking component. We've talked about putting together systems like, let's say, maybe a fodder system, and you're feeding rabbits, and then you're feeding rabbit pellets to worms, and then the worm compost is growing the trees, right? So we've talked about it that way. What we haven't ever done, at least to my memory, is go straight on, full on into this subject. Well, a few weeks ago, I did a podcast exactly like we're talking about. I did like five or six methods of composting, and I mentioned worm composting, and I mentioned Vivor's Worm Bin, and it was close to 50 people picked up that worm bin, and now that I have one in my hands, I'm really glad about that, because it's a hell of a great product. Well, this weekend, you know, I had received this worm bin as a sample from Vivor, and I had to put it together, and I put together a video on it yesterday that's already been released, along with how to buy it, etc., and some really cool things about it that I'll tell you today. But this is not going to be an infomercial for Vivor's worm bin. In fact, we'll probably talk about it, you know, 2 minutes out of the total today, because this is a generalized, how do I use worms to make really great compost podcast. But because of that, I had a whole bunch of material gathered that worked well for a podcast today. And on Thursday, very early before the sun wakes up, I will, of course, the sun doesn't really wake up. Somebody, the sun doesn't wake up. This guy lives in the past. He thinks the sun wakes up. Nah, shut up. You know there's somebody going to do that. Anyway, before the sun is up, I will be hauling ass toward the Austin area, Bastrop, Texas, specifically, to hang out with John Bush, Nicole Sauce, and some other really cool people. I'm going to get to have dinner Thursday night with Nicole and my buddy David. That's something we don't get to do that often, so it'll be cool. But it puts me in a short week, and having so much meat and potatoes ready to go for dinner, we're serving meat and potatoes. We're going to talk about the video, you know, using some of the stuff from the video yesterday. If you watch that video, there is a point where we will have some overlap with it, but this will be its own thing. So I think this will benefit you even if you've already watched the video. And we're going to talk about a bunch today. We're going to talk about why would you even do this? You know, we're going to talk about how worm composting actually works. Most people that are even good at it and teach how to do it and teach how to do it right are doing it in spite of the fact that either they don't know or they don't explain how it actually works. Because the worms don't eat the food. You throw strawberry pieces and cantaloupe pieces and cucumber pieces and, you know, tops off your carrots and stuff like that, and you think the worms, they don't eat them. They don't eat that, right? It's not what they're eating. We'll tell you what they're eating. And when I tell you that, at first you might think, well, that's cool, but does it matter? It matters a lot, especially in the initial setup stages of a worm farm. And I actually think there's a lot of people, because of two big myths that kill their worms, and I'll explain those as we get into today. We'll talk about all the reasons that people kill their worms, and it's never usually malice. If someone wants worms dead, it's pretty easy to do. They're not real good at surviving murder attempts, right? So there's a lot of mistakes that are made. We're going to talk about different styles of worm bins and options, how to set up a new bin, some things to feed and not to feed, and then this is what you really tune in for today. I'm going to tell you the things that I do that very few people do, and some of the things that I do I've literally never heard anybody talk about doing. And I am a content consumer when it comes to stuff like this. I digest hundreds of hours a month in other people's content on the how-tos, the whys, and the what's from the basic overview down to the biology and chemistry of these things, because it's just what I love to do. And so when I say probably no one else is doing some of this, I would say at least some of it no one else is doing, because I would have found them by now if they were public with it anyway. We'll talk about using worm castings, and we'll talk about some rules if you're not going to use it right away. And I'm going to tell you why, if you're buying worm castings in a bag, what you're buying is not great. I want to say it's worthless, but it's not completely worthless, but it's not the same. You're not getting what you think you are, and it's important that you know that. And we'll talk about, at the end, why this is one of the most premium products that a person can produce, even though, you know, somebody that lives in an apartment and their garden consists of a bunch of containers on a patio can do this and produce as high quality as a product as anyone else in the world, maybe higher, because with less to do, you focus more on doing it right. With that, before we jump into it, I want to remind you guys again, it's pretty obvious when you watch this video for any length of time, I got one eye that actually sees. The other one sees shapes and colors and very narrow field of vision, but I'm legally blind in it. That's why it goes off to the side. I'm not, like, you know, looking at something out of the corner of my eye or something. It's just a biological limitation I have. And that means when I'm alone, solo, doing a show, if you want a question answered, it is, and I'm not going to promise to see it, but it's imperative if you want me to possibly see it and mark it for follow-up at the end, that you put the word question in all caps followed by your question and ask that question in a single sentence. And if you're referring to something I just said, please include that in your question so when I'm answering it 35 minutes later, I know what you're talking about, because you may have left and you might come back and watch the replay or something, and if you're not here to tell me what you meant, I won't know and I'll skip over it. All right, so let's talk about our sponsors of the day today. As I just mentioned, I am cruising on down to Bastrop on Thursday. I will be there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, leaving back to here Sunday morning. And I have committed to John. He's doing farm tours on Thursday. I'll be at least one of those. So I'm waiting on him to get me some times and locations of those farm tours. But I figure I can be of benefit. And I actually really want to see that, too. I usually don't get there early enough on the day before the actual event itself to participate in that. I'm making an effort to do that this year. But this is an awesome event. And John's got such a great video about what's going on. I figure I'll just play that for you. It'll give me a breath of air, because it's going to be a long podcast today.
The entire system, government, mega corporations, the media, is basically a big fraud. After COVID, this pandemic, a lot of people woke up. They pushed too hard and caused a lot of people to start questioning the status quo. We decided, let's put together an event, bring together people that want to homestead, that want to build community, but don't know how or don't believe in their ability to do so.
We have the hippies and the lefties, and then we have the Ron Paul libertarians and the Rothbardian and the anarchists.
This homesteading, regenerative agriculture, permaculture, living together, buying land cooperatively, that is the new path forward.
Anyway, guys, I would love to see some of y'all down there. Time is running out, but if you are anywhere in the area, you still have time to get your tickets and attend in person. If you don't want to attend in person, there's different options for virtual attendance of this event. You absolutely can watch most of the presentations streamed for free, and then there's an upgrade from that. All you got to do is go to the website and sign up for the free access. When you do, you will get hit with the things that ask you if you want to upgrade. It doesn't mean that what you did didn't get you access to the basic presentations, but there are some other virtual upgrades as well. If you're coming, I really suggest getting a VIP ticket. Come to the VIP dinner, the extra events and stuff like that, and get all the perks that go along with being a VIP there, including access to the green room, which is where the speakers hang out, which is kind of cool. Next up today, though, I want to talk to you about your doggy and training your dog. And the real reality is all dogs are good dogs, right? All dogs are good dogs. If we have a dog that's not good, in our way of describing what a good dog is, there's two things possible. One's a feral dog, and it's really not a dog as we think of it then. It is a wild animal that needs to be re-domesticated. But most dogs are owned by people. And the person is the problem, not the dog. And everything really starts with the basic core obedience. So I would invite you to check out canineacademy.us. I'd appreciate it if you use my links if you're going to sign up, though, because I do have an affiliate relationship with Joel Riles over there. But if you want to make your dog a good dog, realize that the weak link in the equation is you. I don't mean to pick on anybody. It's just the case. And so you can take the Canine Basics, Canine Academy Basics Core Obedience Program. It's $89, and it will make you better at dealing with dogs for the rest of your life. There's other options as well, but I recommend everybody consider at least the Canine Academy Basics. And there is a problem-solving library. It's kind of like a for you to get a free trial of Joel's teaching, and you can sign up for that absolutely free. And there's a bunch of other courses available. I helped Joel put this whole program together. It's all his methodology, but as far as the way that it's assembled, put it together, presented, and available in kind of bite-sized pieces, I did that as a consulting agreement with him as a barter deal, and I have my amazing dog, my little Malinois, and she's really a Malinois Shepherd, but I don't think you can convince her of that. That dog, as far as she's concerned, is 100% Belgian Malinois. She definitely takes after her dad more than her mom, and she's a beautiful little dog, and she's a fortress canine. And if you want some of the most amazing dogs pre-trained in the world, get on over to Fortress Canine and learn more about that as well. All right, so let's get into this. What is worm composting? And why don't we take the approach that so many advocate as far as worms? Don't worry about worms. Worms live in gardens. Take your food scraps out to your garden. Pull back your mulch. Throw the food on it. Put the mulch back over it. The worms know what to do. It's not a terrible idea. I've never told anybody not to do that. In fact, I tell people to do that all the time. If you're a family of 4 to 6, unless you're going to have a lot of worm farms, you're probably going to have extra compostables that you're going to have to do something with like that anyway. Feed them to chickens, feed them to ducks, put them into a standard compost system, bury them in your mulch, dig pits around your perennials and dump it. I mean, all of that works. But it would be kind of like saying, why would anybody ever need a car? You have a pickup truck. Why doesn't everybody have a pickup truck? They carry things that cars don't. Well, cars have their place. Pickups have their place. They fill different needs for different niches. Like, you know, there's places I would never want to buy. I wouldn't ever want to drive a pickup truck if I could have a smaller car. One time when my wife and I went to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, we landed at the airport. We did the National Emerald Isle, which is like the best thing in the world, by the way. I mean the best thing on planet Earth. If you have to travel and get a rental car, sign up for National's Emerald Isle. You say, like, I want a mid-size, a full-size, whatever car. You show up, you get in the car, you start the car, and you leave. They check your license. You don't even have paperwork. You just pick the color you want and go. Well, when we got there, even though we had that, there was a dude like actively flagging people. You Emerald Isle? Yeah. Would you like a free upgrade to a pickup truck? And I'm like, what kind? He's like a Dodge Ram four-door. And I'm like, hell yeah. Got in it, left, and the second I left, thought, you dumbass, Gatlinburg is a hell of a place to find parking. There's all these tiny side roads and shit. Like, why'd you do that? So, you see what I'm saying? Like, even though I love pickups, there's places I don't want it. And so we should look at worm composting as another tool in the kit. And no one says, why do you have a Phillips screwdriver? That screw over there is for a standard style screwdriver. Because sooner or later, you can run across Phillips. So there's a lot of things we can do with worm composting that just actively decaying organic matter into our garden doesn't do. Like the output product of castings, worm teas, worm extracts, etc., and being able to put them in a concentrated manner wherever we want to. One of the things I'll talk about today is taking worm castings, soak that in a bucket of water to make an extract, strain it out, you can still use those castings directly on the soil, but then take that extract, you know, mix it with some water if you want to dilute it. You don't need to dilute it at all, by the way. put it in a sprayer and foliar spray your plants. Well, putting your banana peel in under your garden mulch won't do that. So there's a lot of things that we'll cover, but there is a reason to do this beyond just throwing everything outside in a big compost pile or something else and saying it'll all just get taken care of. But here's what I wanted to begin with, because I think when you really understand this and you understand the implications of it, a lot of the things that kill worms stop happening, because what kills the worm is inevitably, you know, if you make your own bin, you can screw it up, I guess, but most commercial products that you would buy, whether it's like the Urban Worm Bag, Vivor's multi-tray system, any of the other multi-tray systems, just about any worm bin system, it's probably not the bin, it's the operation thereof. You know, if somebody brought you a car and said, this damn car, Toyota makes garbage-ass cars, you'd be like, wait a minute, Toyota makes pretty good cars. How old is this car? And they're like, it's a 2023. How many miles has it gone on it? 50,000 miles only. Well, shit. What's wrong? Hey, when's the last time you changed the oil? And the person looked at you and said, change the oil? You say, okay, you're the problem. And I think most of what happens with bad results in worm farming and making worm compost is that kind of thing. A person doesn't understand why they need to do things the way that they've been instructed, and because of that, they don't necessarily identify what they've done wrong, and they think they're doing the right thing. So, what I said in the beginning, and people have gotten mad at me for this, and I'm like, go check me if you don't agree with this. Go Google it. It'll take 10 seconds. Worms don't eat the food that we put in the worm bin. And once you understand that, you realize that if that's true, and I'm going to explain how it works in a second, but if that's true, and I put a bunch of worms in a bin, and it's a brand new bin, and I throw a shitload of food in there, an amount of food that amount of worms could process in an optimal condition is probably going to go stagnant, dank, nasty, start to heat up and thermophilically compost, grow mold or fungus. Like, it's going to kill the damn worms once you understand what's really going on. So what the worms actually eat are microorganisms, fungi, and their byproducts. In other words, their poop. And a little bit of the heavily digested food that the microbes have already begun to break down. So when you take some watermelon pieces that went off, you take some carrot tops, you take the tops you trimmed off your strawberries, the peels from your cucumber, and stuff like that, the bad spots you cut off some potato and all, and you put that in your worm bin, I think most people believe those little worms come up there and start eating it. They have no teeth. They have incredibly tiny mouths. They're not capable. Again, what happens is the biology in the bin, which is bacteria and other microbes and fungi, begin to decompose, break down the food, and then the worms go eat the microbes. They go eat the microbe byproduct, and they will eat some of the, like, oozing mush from the biologically broken down food. And when that's in balance, you don't have bad smells, you don't get a bunch of rot, you get a nice balanced ecosystem. Yeah? But they're not eating the food. And I know that sounds crazy, because you stick a piece of strawberry in there, and you go in there the next day, and you lift it up, and there's worms all over it. But they're not eating it the way, like, say, mealworms or black soldier fly do. Like, where you can put that on time lapse, you can see them actually eating it. They don't have the ability. They're up there for a couple reasons. One, very attractive to microbes. Two, it's wet and cold, right? Three, a green country saying they exude sugars from their roots and feed fungi and bacteria. Well, that strawberry is letting some of its sugars leach in liquid form so that worm will consume that. Right? It's just everything they want is there, but the thing is attracting what they're eating more than it is providing them the food that they want. And microbes multiply and concentrate around the food. I've talked about this before. Ray Arculeta actually has a video with night vision, and you see these giant worms in Canada. I mean, these things, like, I'd be afraid to lay on the ground where this field is. This is a no-till multi-generational farm where they practice regenerative agriculture, and the worms in this farm are crazy, and they you know, harvested a crop of corn and put the tops of the corn, instead of taking it as silage away, they flattened it to the ground so that all that organic matter could get absorbed into the ground and become part and incorporated into the soil. Well, at night you hear these sounds, and you watch the video, and it's kind of hard to see, but you see these worms grabbing a big dry corn leaf, pulling it a little bit into the ground, and kind of twisting it and tucking it into the ground. Well, they don't want to eat that leaf. They want the microbes to make that leaf into food for them, whether it's microbes, microbe poop, or broken down leaf. And then they're going to eat that. And so the worms are actually farming the microbes or ranching the microbes. And once you get that, you realize, like, if I don't get the biology up in a bin before I start feeding them in earnest, they can't deal with the amount of food I'm giving them. And so the number one thing that'll kill your worms off in like the first week or two is overfeeding a new system, because the biology has not been established yet. So you need to start out going slow. And again, once you understand that that's what's going on, you have a different perspective on the concept of going slow. And I actually think it makes sense to start out with a much smaller worm population you plan on having. Worms make baby worms, and they make lots of baby worms fast. So if you start out with just a handful of worms and you establish biology first and feed very, very lightly, you will bring the population of microbes and worms up together. You can always add more as the process begins to do better for you as well. But I do think for a lot of people, you know, buying a new worm farm, going to Mr. Jim's or something, buying a whole pound of red wigglers and throwing them into one bin is probably a mistake. You can get away with it, but it's probably not the best idea because of what I just explained. Moving on, what does this mean to proper startup? Again, you got to go slow, out of the gate, give biology time. It also means that if you have mature compost, if you have castings from another active, healthy worm bin, things like that, it makes a lot of sense to seed that biology. If you watched the video I did yesterday, I used CocoCore as a bedding base down in the bottom of the pan. By the way, if you've seen that video and I show you some, like when I remove it, the cheesecloth liner that goes into the basin that keeps worms from ending up in the basin and drowning, and there's some CocoCore that came through. One thing I skipped yesterday, and it's a good idea, you only need to do this with a multi-tray system, and the first time you set it up on the bottom tray, you can lay a couple sheets of paper over that to keep stuff from going through, because once the worms begin the biogel process and all, you don't get that fall through like that. And if you do, and it's an upper tray, you don't care. And by the time your top tray gets to the bottom, you've got great biogels going on, so you don't need to worry about it. But inoculation with compost, worm bin material is a great idea. And one of the things we really need to understand then is, I bet you a lot of people in this audience, right, have heard the concept of worms will eat half their weight a day. So if I have a half pound, or if I have a pound of worms in my system, I can give them a half pound of food. Once that system, assuming it's large enough to support that population, well-balanced, and the microbial population is up, that's probably a good number. But if you think of it as worms will eat half their weight in food a day, it screws everything up mentally. If you think of it as worms teeming with microbes can process half the body weight of the worms a day, that little tiny thing changes everything in your psychology and how you'll manage your bins. So let's talk about other than, and we'll reiterate it because it's true, other than overfeeding. What are the main reasons people set up a worm bin and then the worms end up dead? And as I said in my video yesterday, if you have like a large population of worms all die at the same time, it is one of the dankest, nastiest, stinkingest smells you've ever had. I a couple times in my life, and anybody that uses worms to go fishing has done it one or two times, you leave a container of worms like in the trunk of your car, and you forget on like a Sunday, and they sit there overnight, and the next day, and you go to work, and you don't really smell anything yet because they ain't fully died yet, but then the sun comes out, roasts the worms in your trunk, you come out after work, you get in your car, and even though they're in the trunk, there's this kind of not good smell. It's not really bad. It's just a faint smell of death. And you're like, what is... Oh. And when you open that trunk... Ugh. Okay, and that's a dozen worms. Think about it being 1,000 or 2,000 worms. It's not good. So we don't just not want to lose them. We don't want to deal with that kind of a biological mess. So when I started thinking about doing this episode today, something that happened a long time ago here at one of my workshops jumped right up in my head. It had to do with bees instead of worms. And it was Michael Jordan, the bee whisperer from Wyoming, not the basketball player. The bee whisperer was teaching a class on bees. And he went on this rant finally. He said, if you're a beekeeper, you have to realize that you took the bees that didn't want to be in a box, and you put them in a box. And they can't do the things that they would do out in nature in a box. A box gets hotter than they want it to. A box gets colder than they want it to. A box is designed for the beekeeper, not the bee. They don't want to make honey in a perfectly rectangular cone, but it works better for us. So you put them in the box. So you are responsible to those bees who did not ask you to put them in a box to take care of the box so that the bees can be happy in the box because you put them in the box and they didn't want to go. By the way, this is one of Michael's mental loops. He went on for about 10 minutes, and he was way more animated and angry sounding than I am. But he made a valid point. He started going on this thing, goes, so the bees did this. That means you're a shitty beekeeper. The bees had this happen. That means you're a shitty beekeeper. And that went on for 10 minutes. People learned a lot. But it applies here. Worms don't live in boxes. Worms live in the ground. And depending on what kind of worms they are, they stratify at different layers, and they live in different conditions. And if this place gets a little bit dry, they can move over here where it's a little bit more wet. If it gets a little too hot here, they can move over here where it's a little more cold. And they're pretty mobile. You know, they move faster than we think. To move a couple feet, it's actually dramatic how quickly they can do that. And they can slowly migrate in and out of areas based on needs when they're in nature. You put them in a box, they got nowhere to go except up and down. So if the box's internal temperature is too high, too low, the moisture's too much, it's too little, they're going to die. So just understand that. So the big thing right out of the gate is location. I don't know why my worms died, but where are they? I put them in this worm thing. I did everything they said to do, and they died. Where's the worm thing? Whatever the hell that means. I'll put it outside. Does the sun hit it? Yeah, you fried your worms. Is it January? Yeah, you froze your worms. Right? They can't get out. So location, location, location. Where do the worms get real estate? You want a place where they won't get too wet, where they're in shade, where they won't freeze solid. That means you might have to move a worm bin different times of the year to different locations to adapt to that, right? Next up, number one reason. And I believe this is probably more true than anything else, too wet. People think wet, 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 wet. And you know the little nozzle will let the leachate, they call it worm tea, but that ain't worm tea, that's leachate out the bottom of these bins. That's a good feature to have on that bin. That should be there. At some point in time, there will be more moisture than you intended, there will be some seepage through, and that leachate is gold, and you should use it as a fertility aid. But it is not an intentional product that you're trying to produce. If you're getting leachate out of your worm farm on a daily basis, it is too wet. It is only a matter of time before there's an infestation of pests that will kill your worms. Your worms will get in an anaerobic environment and drown or die from anaerobics. Or the microbe population will crash, and then soon the worms that depend on the microbes will crash. Something is going to kill your worms. And wet is way more common than too dry, and I think one of the biggest reasons is that little nozzle. Well, shit, I want that leachate. Everybody talks about how great it is. I ain't getting none. I add more water. If you get no leachate ever, and your worms are happy and healthy, leave it alone. It's more a fail-safe in case. If you build your own bin and you put drainage in the bottom, it is a fail-safe. It is not an intended result. And I don't know why, and I've listened to people that are very smart about worms not explain that. I've even inferred from what they said that they knew it, but they don't come out and flat out say, don't do this on purpose. No, you should not have a little cup of leachate every day. You're overwatering your worms. Number one, too wet. Number two, too much food. Too much food, and often what happens with too much food
is you put too much food, you realize you did too much food, so you throw a whole bunch of carbon in there. It seems like a good idea because food and carbon sources should go together, bedding and food. But what ends up happening is since you didn't take any of the excess nitrogen out and you added carbon, you created compost, like old school compost, like thermophilic compost, and it kicks off. You open the thing, and it's a little bit warm in there. I guess that's okay. It's not okay. That can get up to 160 degrees. Worms, red wigglers can handle more heat than night crawlers, but they can't handle that, and they're in a box. So maybe it's only a few inches on the top that's 160 degrees, but it's going to bring the, over time, they'll go deeper, and eventually you're going to fry them. And they'll die. So overfeeding, between anaerobics, it makes things too wet. It causes a thermophilic reaction. Next is too dry. This is not as common because you're feeding a wet food source. You should be keeping an eye on it. If things get too dry, you can add a little bit of water. You can always add more. You can't. It's hard to get it back out, so be careful with it. But if you get into a truly dry situation, where there is no, like when you stick your hand out, their worms are probably already dead. They need some moisture. The microbes need moisture. And then the other thing is, once you go dry like that, the product that you have remaining is fairly useless. It probably needs to be mixed into like an active compost and allowed to recompost because it goes thermophilic and it then repels water. So if you've taken my compost course, you know that that can happen in more than just worm bins. But you have to be really careful to not let it dry out as well. Next is bad airflow. Now, if you design your own bin and you don't account for reasonable airflow through the bin, it can be the bin's fault. If you buy a product that is known to be a decent product on the market, and you have airflow problems, it's because you're too wet or you're overfeeding. And because of the wet and moisture and the bedding and the soil and the castings can't breathe, it takes a lot for a bin to have such poor airflow that it kills worms if everything else is correct. But there should be some level of airflow through it. And if you're routinely checking on your worms and checking your surface and all, you're helping that by removing the cover and checking things out. And this is another thing about worms. Yeah, you can go on vacation for a week if you have a well-balanced, well-tuned-up bed. You come home, everything will be fine. Just make sure everything's the way you want. Come back. But on an ongoing basis, you have to treat worms like you do bees in a lot of ways, which means, you know, this is one of the reasons I hate the flow hive. The flow hive fixes everything. You don't ever have to take the lid off to get the honey out. You draw honey like once a year. You should be in your hive twice a month minimum. Your worm farm at least once a week, if not, you know, like two or three times a week, especially in the beginning during establishment. And we'll talk about more about that as well. So bad airflow, environment is too hot, too cold. Pesticide residue happens sometimes, but most of us are feeding our worms food that we're willing to eat. So it's not likely, but it is something to be aware of. You can nuke a worm farm with minute amounts of pesticides. You really can. Insufficient carbon bedding. So whenever you feed, whatever you're using is like a top dress bedding, leaves, paper shavings, coca core, whatever, you should pull that back, lay your new food down, kind of take a look at what's going on, push that back over, and probably add a little bit just about every time. And if you're not doing, and what you'll notice is when you put something like shredded paper on the top of your worm farm, and then it's like bone dry, when you open it the next time, it's going to be like, it's, you know, it was all fluffed up. It's going to be matted down and being incorporated. But what it's doing is actually wicking moisture up, and it's helped balancing the moisture. And you really want to use some kind of a coverage mat, something like a coca core mat that's cut to the dimensions of the top, or a few layers of newspaper or something that goes down on top of that as a flat layer. We'll talk about why doing that in just about a little bit more is a good idea. Infestations can be a problem too, with other things getting in there. Somebody already asked a question. I think that's what it was about, so we'll take it here. We'll see as he's waiting. No, it's not the question. It was an email somebody sent me, so this is going to get covered in this episode. When you take material from outside, there's always a potential to bring something into your worm bin that you don't want. When it's compost, I don't worry about it very much, because I'm going to take nice, crumbly, dirt-looking compost, and I'm going to take some handfuls of it, and I'm going to inoculate with that. I'm not too worried about that, because down in the compost, you're not going to have a lot of things that you really don't want. When I use wood chips, and I do, what I do with wood chips is I take them and I put them in something like a bus tub or a bucket, and I completely saturate them with water till like there's more water than chips. The chips are literally floating up off the bottom. And I leave them for a day. And I do that because there are some things that I'd prefer not to have in a worm bin, like centipedes, because they're a predator of worms, right? So by doing that, everything that can get out, 86 is the AO, everything that can't drowns. You then drain that really good so it's not too wet, and that's a great bedding material as well as wood chips like that, especially aged, older wood chips. And fungi and a lot of the bacteria will survive a full day soaking like that. Not all of it, but some of it, enough to be some more seed material. But infestations could be an issue. The worst are fire ants, and that's my nemesis here. I've been able to do a great deal of fire ant control with my big bioreactor composting simply by about every 2 weeks I mix up a 2 gallon can of water and orange oil at 1 tablespoon of orange oil to the gallon, and right around the edges outside the bioreactor I pour that, and that's knocked that out. You can't be doing that inside your worm bin. You can't be dumping it in there. But that has helped a lot. So a little bit of orange oil. The Vivor product has these little feet that are like water traps. You might fill that up with water and then put, you know, a quarter teaspoon of orange oil in each one, because they seem to not only die from it, they don't seem to like the aroma at all. Like maybe they just know it's going to kill them. But if they get it on their body, it eats their exoskeleton. So fire ants are a big one. But I'll tell you some stuff that people say are not a problem that can be a problem. And that is black soldier flies. And if there's a few black soldier flies that end up coming out of your worm bin, it again, it's not that big a deal. If you're doing commercial compost in these massive bins, it doesn't seem to be that big a deal. But I've had them get into things like the Urban Worm Bag Farm. And they alter the composting process, and they move much faster. And the worms will be happy to eat the biology that they create. But a black soldier fly bin can heat up, and heat and worms are bad. So that's another one to look out for. At least do some control measures if they start showing up. Gnats and things like that can be problematic. But it's ants that are your biggest problem, because they'll literally, once they realize, hey, it's moist in here, there's protein, and there's sugar, and there's all these little cool plates, they'll colonize. And once they colonize, they'll kill every damn worm you have. And then it'll sting the shit out of you when you open it up. So be careful with that. Another one is ammonia buildup. And this is almost always improper feeding. And specifically what I'll say for the things not to feed them. But your meats and stuff like that will often fail to break down because they have a different process by which they are consumed by biology. And so it doesn't fit this system. So it begins to rot and it off-gasses ammonia. And again, if I threw a dead animal on the ground, you could probably pick it up after the maggots are eating it and stuff a few days later and dig down in the soil just a little bit, and there's worms under there, but they're not in a box. Remember what Michael Jordan said about the bees? You put them in the box. They didn't ask you to put them in a box, so you have to manage the box so that it suits them, not that they have to manage the box so it suits you. Yeah. And then overfeeding one thing. Like, I think, for instance, coffee grinds. Fantastic thing to put in your worm farm. But let's say you know somebody works at Starbucks, so they give you a big bag of spent grinds every week, and you keep feeding them that. There is a chance over time that you will have problems in your bin because you're not creating any variety. And everything has toxins in it. Everything has toxins. Everything you consume, especially plant-based, has toxins. And so if I feed you one thing all the time, especially one plant-based thing all the time, you can build those toxins up. You can also skew the biology. So even if everything, like, well, I fed my worms nothing but coffee grounds for 4 years. They're happy as shit. Yeah, but the biodiversity of your final product isn't what you want it to be. By having multiple feedstocks, you have greater biodiversity. And that's like I've learned in the last few years how important that is with bioreactor composting. You know, having a product with 300 beneficial organisms in it instead of 30 is a huge difference on the long-term impact on your plants, your land, your garden, etc. Moving on, let's talk about bin styles and options. One of my favorites is the Urban Worm Bag. I'm not going to pull anything up on screen today, but I've had that product reviewed before for you. There'll be a link in the show notes, and if you want to get to the show notes for the audio side and you're watching the video, right down there in the video notes, the first big link will take you over to the audio version. If you're watching me live, it's not there yet because we're not done yet. This is live, not Memorex. When it becomes Memorex, that will be there, and all these links and things for you will be there as well. But it's a good product. It's a good product because it suspends the farm off the ground. I've not had a single ant end up in it. In spite of the fact that it zippers together really well, it seems like black soldier flies love the damn things. So maybe if I put it in a different building than I had it in, if I put, I don't know, some sort of a thin mesh screen frame over the top of it. But I had both of mine last year got heavily invaded by BSLs. And this was inside a building where the door was kept shut. And this is why I know that if you get enough BSL in a box, or in this case a bag, they will heat things up even if you do everything else right. They also just go through all the food. So it's a different compost, and I want to keep them separated. The other thing that it works, but I'm not in love with it, is the way that one empties. So they have a fitting on the bottom. You take off some things, take some Velcro and unzip it, and pull it down, you harvest from the bottom. And this is nice because your worms are constantly migrating where the food is toward the top, and so you get mostly just castings out of the bottom. But all in, I like it. I'll continue to use it. But systems like the Vivor's Trade system seem to be a little bit more user-friendly, especially for new people to me. But the big thing with the Urban Worm Bag is it's very breathe-friendly. It breathes beautifully. So it's something to consider. They're about $130, and they are awesome, and they produce a lot of castings, so they're very good. The next is the like home-built style tubs out of like a Rubbermaid tub, and I've seen everything just from a Rubbermaid tub with some holes in it so it'll breathe, some holes around the top edge but not in the top so that it can breathe, and you put your bedding in and you just raise worms in one bin. And so for $15, you can start doing that. And then what people do when they want to harvest castings is they just start pulling everything out and they lay it like on a board and you wait and you put a light over it or set it out in the sun and your worms just haul ass as deep as they can go. And then you skim a layer off and you harvest that. And you skim a layer off and you harvest it till you get down to it's all worms. You put them in like a secondary container for a bit and you keep doing it until you have wormless castings. And if there's a worm or two in there, it ain't no big deal. Then you put all the worms back in and you restart everything. I'm not a huge fan of this because you're taking this giant colony of worms and kind of rebooting everything. And your highest quality castings are in the bottom. Because as you add in layers, they keep going up. So kind of the trick for that then is to take a couple inches off. Put that, worms or not, in a separate container, nice cool location until you're done. Then do what I just said until the bin's almost empty. Then take that material as your base bedding with new carbon and reestablish your bed. I have a much easier way to do this. Take your bin and divide it in half with a piece of like quarter inch hardware cloth. Just cut a piece the height of your bin or close to the height of your bin. Put breaks in it on both sides. That basically means put a bend in it. drill some holes, and bolt it right down the center of that bin. When you establish it, do it on one side. And do it till you're pretty close to full. Take some of that material as seed material, move it to the empty side, and start composting there. Stop feeding the side that's full. And wait. And in about a week, you can start harvesting that other side. When you see heavy activity on the new side, when you pull back things and there's worms everywhere, they've kind of given up on this other side because there's no food in it. Then the other thing to really make this work, when you want to harvest your castings, get up very early in the morning and do it then, because they'll be closest to the surface when it's darkest. I don't know exactly how a worm is photosensitive to light, but they are very photosensitive, like they have no eyes. When light is their enemy. Light is where birds are. Light is where frogs are. Light is where lizards are. Light is where little kids putting them in a can to go fishing with are, right? So they're gonna want to go down when they see light. So if you get up first thing in the morning, a lot of times, if that's when you check your worm bin, it's been super dark. Even the little bit of light that drifts in is gone. They're happy. You go check your worm bin at noon, you know, unless it's in a dark room with the light off, a lot of times there's not a lot of worm activity. They went down because of the light. So you got your new side set up, you got complete darkness. The other thing you can do, if you've done that, is you take a light like a desk lamp that bends over and set that up and point it down on the side you want to harvest, the old side, and just start taking layers off. Well, every time you take a layer off, the ones that are just below that layer, they're going to haul ass down, 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 and eventually they're going to haul ass to the other side. So if you're going to do a system in totes and you're not going to make a layered stack system, then I would take that divided system approach. And that works really, really well. I still think things like a stack system tend to work better, especially for really quick, like once you get all five trays into a system like that, every week to 2 weeks, you're pulling the bottom tray out and there's nothing to do. It's dump and use. And if there's a few worms in there, let them go. Set them out in the garden. There's no such thing as too many worms in your garden. The next is large-scale outdoor systems. And I'm not really going to talk about these. I'm going to acknowledge them. So some of the things I say about keeping them indoors, controlling temperature, all this shit, somebody's going to be like, I've grazed 900 bazillion worms a year. I have these long rows of boxes in the tree line on the side of my farm. They're a side hustle like you talk about, Jay. And I raise a gazillion, bazillion, batrillion worms. Yeah, you also have enough space to do that. Your box is very large. A lot of times those systems actually have ground contact and the worms can move in and out of them. And so when you do that, things are totally different. So I'm not going to talk about how to do that because I've never done it, but I've seen it done. And I'll just acknowledge it for you that if you're doing that, yes, I understand. And you probably think people that buy bins and buy worm farms and all are stupid because you raise a gazillion, bajillion, quadrillion worms a year. But you're talking about somebody that lives in a house, doesn't raise a bazillion, quadrillion worms in a year, doesn't have enough food for a bazillion, quadrillion worms, and they're in it for a totally different reason than you are. They want to be able to take the food waste from 2 to 4 people in their family and process it into something valuable. So they're going to take a different approach. And next, commercial multi-tray systems like the Vivor worm bin. And what I love about these systems is, number one, they're purpose-built. We've gotten really good at how to build these things. There's 100 different versions, but they're all pretty close to the same in design. You have a tray, you set your worms up, just like we'll talk about in a second, we've already kind of inferred. Your worms do their thing, they make enough shit that you're ready to say, hey, this is probably ready to add another layer. You put a new pan in, you set it up exactly the way you did the first pan, and the worms themselves go, hey guys, we're out of food. Let's move on up to the east side, and some of you get that, some of you too young. They crawl on up to the next tray, and they start feeding on it. And when that one's ready, you add another tray, and you keep doing that for as many trays as you want to add. Personally, I think it makes a lot of sense to keep going until as ever many trays as your system has, that's how many you have. When you get to that point, you take off your top trays, you take your bottom tray, you harvest. You drop them down. You take the bottom tray. You put new bedding in it. Seed it with a little bit from the prior the last tray down. Get it going again. Put your cover on it. Start feeding your worms. And what I love about that is once you get a system like that rolling, there's no real reboot. If, let's say, we have a five-tray system, we're only taking 20% of the total system at any given time. And we're immediately taking that 20% of capacity and moving it to the top. So the worms are never disrupted from the rhythm that you've established. And so to me, it is the most sensible way to do things. And it's kind of like reverse beekeeping again. And you don't go to the next tray until the last tray is pretty full. Until, you know, like, that's enough. And you do it for kind of the same reason beekeepers don't add another honey box, a super, up on top of the hive until the last one, the comb's drawn out, you know, depending on where you're at, it's full of brood or it's full of honey or whatever. And then and only then will we give them another place to work. And when they fill that one, we'll give them another one. Now, of course, when we harvest honey, we're coming from the top down, and we have some place that queen can't get to, so there's no brood above a certain part. Usually just your main box is where your brood is. But we're harvesting for the, we're doing the exact opposite with the worms. We're harvesting from the top or from the bottom up. But it's the same process. We're controlling migration, but the worms feel like, hey, this is a worm paradise. I don't ever get yanked out of my box. I don't have to start all over. Half my population doesn't die. I really think for the average person, they're the best type of system to be using. There are, you know, things like in-bed worm towers. I love these, but I'm back to the car versus truck discussion. You take a big old piece of pipe or an old flower pot or something like that with no bottom, and you make holes in it so worms can go in and out from the soil profile. You throw a little bit of compost in the bottom of it. You throw some bedding in there, and you start throwing your food scraps in it. The beauty of this is it's a box, but it's a box they can move in and out of, so you don't have to really manage the box as heavily. And so I love these, but they're limited. They're limited because you're going to have the material moved in and out by other soil critters as well, so they have a limited area of impact. But they're very easy to do, and if you wanted to go out and you had, like, say, 6 4x8 beds and you put two towers in every bed and that was your whole solution, I have no problem with that. You even could take some castings out, but it's not the same product. It just isn't. It's a good way to handle things, but I don't consider it worm farming in the way that we're talking about today. And I do want to talk a little bit when it comes to harvesting castings is to not worry that there's some worms in there. I think it's a good idea if you can pick some worms out and throw them back in there and keep your population up and all. Just don't sweat it. And you'll also probably notice something when you harvest your worm castings. They're going to be very wet compared to a product you got in a bag. And it's okay that they dry out some. And if you're sifting them around or something, you may want to dry them out a little bit. Let me tell you what you don't want to do. You don't want to dry them all the way out. You do not want to dry them all the way out. I mean, even 20 minutes spread out is enough to get them out of that mucky, cakey-like thing. You can then put them through like a sifter. So, you, again, take something like quarter-inch hardware cloth, build a little frame you can sift through. That'll help you find a lot of baby worms that you missed. They can go back in, and then you have a nice product that you can use. And we'll talk about how to use it here in a minute. Let's talk real quick about how to set up a new bin. Again, my video goes through it step-by-step, so I'm going to go fast so this doesn't turn into a 3-hour seminar for a podcast. But one of the most important things, we want to add a carbon-based bedding first. Shredded paper, shredded leaves, coca coir. Like, there's tons of options. Purpose made, like Fabril makes a worm bedding. Magic Worm Company makes a worm bedding. You know what those two are, though? Shredded paper, put through a process, made it to like a pulp that's then made like into pellets that are really soft and easy to work with. But in the end, it's paper. We use paper all the time in our worm farms. We have a simple office paper shredder. One of my granddaughter's jobs is come in here every once in a while, pick up all my old guest surveys and stuff like that, go in there and shred the paper. We throw it straight in. The inks we use are non-toxic. Most of your news, in fact, all your newspapers today and everything, it's all soy-based inks. All the things that you've heard about terrors and horrors and chromium and whatever the fuck else you've heard about, if you use newspaper or whatever, you're going to kill your worms or kill yourself or give yourself ass cancer. So it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit at this point. It just doesn't exist. I'm sure there's some corner in China that they're still printing newspapers on lead-based inks or something. All the shit you're using in America and the developed world, don't worry about it. If it can shred up, a worm can process it back into something, unless, like, you know, I talk about using, like, throw your old paper towels and shit in there, not the ones you wiped up oil with, not the one you wiped the grease off your griddle with. But if, you know, all that was on that paper toweling was like you wiped up some wet stuff off your countertop and you were going to throw it away, throw it in your compost. They'll be happy to have that as a carbon source. So we put down a carbon source bedding. I really recommend, again, adding some active compost if you have it. When I say active, I mean biologically active, not thermophilically active, just to be clear. And it can be like what I put in it was equivalent of about 4 double handfuls. But even a handful will help with biology. The thing is, I really believe that since worms love living in my compost, it makes good bedding for them. They like it. It's also a source of food and nutrition as they're establishing the biology to deal with a new concept for that colony of worms, which is strawberries and, you know, peelings from cucumber and the microbiology that goes along with that we're going to be putting in there. So I think it really accelerates bringing up the biology. That's been my experience. And we're going to introduce worms. Now, if you watched my video yesterday or you go watch it later, cardboard boxes, Dante says, yeah, the paper shredder we have does a great job with regular thickness cardboard. Like the super corrugated heavy-duty shit, it doesn't work. But regular size cardboard, I'll cut that up, and I'll put that through there too. And it works just fine. And we'll talk about biochar in a bit there, Dead Rider, because that is under one of my headings today. But when it comes to introducing worms, I didn't get worms from somewhere. I didn't go to my compost pile and like sort through it. I just took a few handfuls of compost, and since it was a bioreactor, I took like a couple handfuls here, a couple handfuls here, and a couple handfuls there, so that when I pushed all the wood chips back and spread it back out, it would not really make like a giant dent in the top of my bioreactor. Well, when I pulled that out, every handful I looked at had little worms all in it. And I know the red wigglers because I introduced them into the bioreactor that was used to seed that bioreactor. So I'm good. And there's probably 50 to 100 little, you know, young worms in there. I didn't see any big ones, even for red wigglers. They're pretty little. Little juveniles. Probably shit tons of cocoons and, you know, worm eggs and baby worms too small for me to see that just hatched. I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to do shit. I just have to, like, let the population start to grow, and I'll tell you some tricks to that here in a minute. Like, I'm going to give you some things that I have not heard any other person teach that I know work from experimentation in a minute. But you can either add worms you buy or source from somebody else. You know, if you're thinking about buying worms, my biggest advice is don't until you're sure you have to. I'm all for selling worms, but buying them, I don't know. You know, check your local Craigslist for worms and stuff like that. But honestly, next door, odds are somewhere within a bike ride of your house, somebody's vermicomposting. And if you can't get worms from your own compost or whatever, and you post on Nextdoor, I'm looking to start vermicomposting. Does anybody already do it and have some worms I can get from you? Somebody will give you a handful of worms, and that's all you need to get started. In fact, I think it makes a lot of sense to start out with a small population, let it expand, and then increase the feed. You're going to get a much better odds of long-term success instead of just throwing a pound of worms in there that costs you $60 freaking. Right? Instead of buying the worms, buy the dadgone good worm farm from Vavor for $60 and get free worms. And, you know, we always talk about using red wigglers. They are kind of the heroes of composting. Don't think that night crawlers don't work. One of the problems, though, is when they get really big, they have a hard time migrating through the holes in those trays. So that's another reason to stick to red wigglers. But if you're using something other than a perforated tray system, there's nothing wrong with night crawlers. What I will say about them is they no worm wants to be hot, but the heat threshold for a night crawler is lower than the heat threshold for a red wiggler. That's just been my experience as times have gone by. Next, you're going to feed slowly at first. You can feed them nothing at first. I'm dead serious. Like, this is not a cat. It's not going to be out killing robins in 2 days and look like it's withering away to nothing. You're not going to starve them to death. If you put enough carbon in there, it's a slower breakdown, but they'll eat. That's what they eat in your garden. Most of what they eat in your garden is wood chips, leaves, mulch, detritus. That's what they eat. It just takes longer to break down, and you're doing it to get rid of a waste product that they can handle if you balance it right. So in the beginning, like what I did yesterday, I put 2 Swiss chard leaves in there and the chopped up core of a single jalapeno. That was not enough to cause a problem even if they didn't touch it. It's just a little seed food, and I might have added a little bit more feed if I was going to be here, but since I'm leaving, I don't want to get my wife and everything to check on. So they're just going to sit like that for about a week. Except for one thing. It's in my little special segment that I'll give you here in a second.
All right.
And so feed slowly at first. Every time you add food, you add carbon. Food first, carbon on top. And I like pulling back the existing carbon layer and going underneath it and pushing it back over. I really don't want my carbon and my nitrogen, which is all my wet stuff, mixed heavily. I want them in layers. I want the worms coming up and eating the microbes that are on the thing from the bottom and everything kind of settling down and then doing it again until we build up those castings. Do not feed until the vast majority of the last feeding is gone. What do I mean by that? You open your worm bin and you have new scraps for them. And most of what you put in there the last time you fed them is still there. Do not add more food. They're not ready for it yet, or that food would be gone. It would absolutely be gone. So that's another thing. And in time, you'll find a schedule and set of procedures that work for you. Once you're doing something and it's working, like right here, Crockpot Broccoli said, regular earthworms seem to work fine for me. So I would never tell him you need to switch to red wigglers, just as an example. Or if somebody said, you know, I feed 3 times a week and everything's working just fine, I would never, because I don't know how, I don't know what that means. Maybe I feed 1 time a week, but I'm feeding almost as much food 1 time a week as you're feeding 3 times a week. Once you have something working, stick with it. Find the procedure, the protocols that work for you, and stick with them, and then keep an eye on things. The other thing about that is now you've learned, right? You've learned what works for you, and you learn what work looks like. If you start to notice something different is usually, not always, but usually bad and always worth paying attention to. If you always put, you know, a double handful of food in on Wednesday, and when you check Sunday morning, it's gone, and it's not, something changed. Now, it might not be bad, it just might, you got a cool snap, they're a little less active, right? Who knows? But check on it. This is why I also like people to have 2 bins, especially when you're new. Any beekeeper will tell you, get 2 hives, never get 1 to start out. You don't know anything. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know what bad is. I opened the hive. There were bees in there. One of them stung me in the face. They all looked happy. Are they? You know, you've put that next box on. They're drawing comb out. Are they? Yeah, they're in there. They're making some honey. But if you had 2 hives and you looked at one was just kicking ass, and the other one wasn't keeping up with it, you'd know something's not right. If you have 2 worm farms, side by side, same location, you're keeping them in the same place, you're running them the same way, you look in one and the other one's not doing as well, you know to start trying to figure out what is the differential, what is causing this problem. You know, if you have pill bugs in it, and I never have a problem with pill bugs, but if you have pill bugs in one and not in the other, then something's up, and the pill bugs might be the variable to look into. And it may be that they're there, and that means something else got there, especially if you didn't put them there, right? Because, I got no problem. Pill bugs and worms go together. They're buddies. They're friends. They like each other. I got no problem with pill bugs. In fact, they're another mechanism of breakdown of the compostables that produce a product that the worm actually wants to eat other than the compostable. Yeah. But if you see a variable, like this one has a thing and this one doesn't, and the thing that has it's doing good or the thing that doesn't has it's doing good, that's a clue that something's wrong. And if you, again, if you're new to something, how would you know? I open it up, there's worms in there. It must be good. Well, is it? Again, if you have like a kick-ass population and a limp-along population, you know, start feeling them. Is one warm? Well, it's got too much feed and it's starting to thermophilic. You know, is one really wet, right? Well, that's probably your problem. But what is really wet? You like, one's doing really good, one's not, but the one that's drier is the one it's too dry. You see what I'm saying? By having a comparative thing to look at side by side, you have a lot more information and you can process more food that way faster. Also, though, when you're done feeding, you're done doing your maintenance, whatever, you should have something that completely covers the surface. It blocks light. It makes them happy. They come all the way up. They work more because that's blocked in. It reduces the speed of evaporation, and it keeps pests like fruit flies out. If you have, let's say, a coquequart mat that you cut to the size of your bin, a fruit fly doesn't want to go to do the work to get in there. It's just not worth it to them. Black soldier flies will totally lay eggs on top of it, and their maggots will find their way in. But many other insects, you'll have less gnat problems. You'll have less fly problems, etc., if you do that. If you don't have a coquequart mat, it can literally be a few, you know, pages, like a quarter inch thick of damp newspaper on the top. But something should actually act as a cap on top of your bed for best results in reducing a lot of your problems. Now, let's go ahead and move on from there and talk about what to feed and not to feed. Pretty much most, not all, but if it was a vegetable or a plant or anything like that, right, and it's not ever been cooked and it's not had oil or grease on it and it's not an animal product, you can probably feed it, including things that have organic components that we don't think of as food. So tea bags, you just pull the, if you have like, you know, you just throw the tea bag in there. The only thing I would say is that if you have a tea bag, it has some tea bags have a little staple, you may want to pull that out because that metal's never going to compost and you probably don't want it in there. But other than that, the string, the tab, the bag, you just throw that shit in there. Coffee, you can throw the whole damn coffee with, if you use filters, the whole filter can go straight in there. They'll eat it. It's just more carbon. They have no problem with that. So most uncooked vegetative waste. You don't want onions, you don't want garlic, you don't want citrus peel. If you end up with, like, you have your little container and you squeeze some lime in some soda water and one lime wedge gets in your worm bed, it's not a big deal. But you don't want to be feeding it to them regularly, and it's a variety of things. But basically, I can tell you that what people think the problem is isn't. This is, again, why I started off with the worms don't eat the food. So then the worm doesn't eat the citrus peel. Because the worm doesn't eat the watermelon rind either. The microbes do. But citrus and the oils in citrus peel are a antibiologic. They're an antibacterial. They're an antibiotic. So they resist being broken down. There's antibiotics and antimicrobials and alliums like garlic and onion. This is why they're so beneficial to us as a tonifying food source. Especially when we consume them raw. Well, if the worms don't want the food and the microbes break down the food and the food is resistant to the microbe, there's your problem. So if you don't understand that the worms don't eat the food, the microbes break down the food, and the worms eat the microbe and the microbe product, you don't get that. And so that's what, so you can really look at it this way. If it's a thing that if you laid it on the ground would still be there in a week and not look like anything ever happened to it. Maybe it dries up, that's about it, but it doesn't begin to break down. It's probably not good for worms to eat. It really is that simple. Next, dry leaves are good for the bedding, but don't do much to absorb moisture. So what I like about paper, what I like about coquequart, whatever, if you do get too much moisture, they're pretty good at redistributing that moisture so you don't have really wet spots and really dry spots. So I love leaves, And I think they are a great top bedding. They're a great bottom bedding, too. But I still like to have some other source of more absorbent carbon to help with that distribution of moisture in there as well. Again, I mentioned this before, but paper towel waste is fine, but what was on it? If you spilled some olive oil and wiped it up off the counter with a paper towel, do something else with that. Anything I have with grease and oils on it, I have a flower pot with like a little improvised lid. I throw that shit in there. When I want to start a fire, I take some of that out and poof, right? That's the, we buy the bacon that's pre-cooked sometimes from Costco and has these layers of wax paper with bacon grease on it. It's the best fire starter on the planet, but it doesn't go to worms. It just doesn't go to worms. A lot of things like that, you can use bokashi, which somebody mentioned here, but we're not covering it today. I throw it into my pit, the chickens, the ducks, whatever. By the time that pit's ready to go into bioreactor compost, these problems are long gone. It's not that they can't be composted. Next, again, no oils, no fats, no animal product. And again, it's not that the worm won't eat, you know, some leftover steak that's kind of gone off in the refrigerator. It won't eat the watermelon either. It's the bacteria you don't want to break it down. Generally speaking, no cooked food. When you cook food, you alter its biochemistry, and it's going to be broken down by a different set of microorganisms than food that you want to feed to your worm system. And again, think of it that way. Feed the system, not feed the worm. And everything, again, gets more clear. No grass. I do not like grass. I don't care if it's dry. I don't care if it's fresh. No grass. Now, in my like microbioreactors, I guess you call them, the compost systems that I taught you guys how to build 15 years ago out of a garbage can with a single pipe up the center for airflow and some other things done to it, I threw grass, I threw all kinds of shit in there, and worms lived in there. But again, they could migrate in and out of the system. If you start throwing grass in your worm farm, it is only a matter of time before you kick off a thermophilic cycle and you cook your worms to death. You may get away with it for a while, but you're just better off just not doing it. And when I say grass, that means hay. That means straw. Those are just dried out grass, different forms of grass. If you use straw that stayed dry and it was only a top bedding, it would be okay. But there's so many other things you can use that work better than that. Because if you get it incorporated, you have a really strong chance of kicking off a heat-based compost. So just forget grass. There's so many other things that work better. And again, coffee grinds are great, but in my experience, they're slower than some other things. So if you have a big supply of coffee grinds, that is an ideal food source for black soldier flies. They love the shit out of that. People look at coffee grinds because they're a dark color and they think of them as a carbon, but they're not. Right? So because they're slower, you have to limit how much you provide them, I guess, is one way to look at it. And I don't like using a lot of any one thing. All right, moving on. I'm going to give you a bunch of stuff that I do, and most of it I've never heard of anybody doing before. One, I keep a ball jar, just a little quart ball jar, because I don't use a lot at a time, of kelp meal next to my worm system. And every time I feed it, I put about a teaspoon, not even a full teaspoon of kelp meal, I just sprinkle around the top. You don't want a lot of it, because it's high protein and nitrogen, and you don't want to be kicking off no thermophilic cycles. And I do when I pull the bedding, or the, you know, the bedding carbon layer on the top back, it goes underneath that. Why am I doing that? Because it's rich in minerals. The microbes are going to process it. It's going to get incorporated with all of their work. The worms are going to eat it and those minerals. And there's like a shit ton of micro trace nutrient minerals in kelp meal are going to pass through that worm and come out in the casting. Now, when I'm using the castings later, I'm adding additional micronutrient to my garden. That alone is probably worth tuning in today for, right? On that note, I also usually include some biochar. I keep a jar of biochar. I throw a tablespoon or two of biochar in every time I feed. This is going to end up with the biochar mixed thoroughly throughout the system, right? Because you're adding it in little bits. So now we're taking a house and we're giving the microorganisms a house to live in. And we're building up the long-time biological validity of the worm castings. It's awesome. How fine is that, Jack? Mitchell, ask that again. Put question with it in case I don't get right to it. And how fine is what? How fine is what? Because I don't know. If you mean the biochar, it's fine. It will at least go through a quarter-inch hardware cloth. At least. I grind my biochar in a leaf shredder. And I can't get into what you have to do that without making mud or a cloud today. But that's what I do. And so it's as fine as you make it. All right. And if it's a little bit bigger, it's a little bit bigger. It's okay. Next, I put green sand or rock dust in as well. And I generally mix that with the kelp meal. So I'll put, like, in the jar, it's about half rock dust and half kelp meal, and I'll mix that up. I do that for the same reason as kelp meal. Nutrient. Micro mineral nutrient. So now that worms don't have teeth, and some of the stuff they eat needs to be processed like they have teeth. So they have a gizzard, kind of like a bird. And so they'll eat grit. What a lot of people just use is play sand. And if you use play sand, it'll work for that grinding, but it's not mineral rich. Green sand, azomite, rock dust, all those things are hugely rich in micronutrients. So that little bit over time ends up with this massive nutrient profile at the end. Again, these minerals. And we can create a lot of things in our gardens with composting, but I keep saying this, you can't create mineral that you don't have. Mineral equals element. Elements over a certain atomic weight, they get created in stars. They get created in nuclear fusion reactions. If you have no manganese in your soil, in your backyard, unless you somehow bring it in, you will never have it. It will not get created. It doesn't exist. You probably have more than you think you do, but if you're truly deficient, you need to bring in some of these minerals. And this is a really simple way to function stack in doing that. When it comes to eggshells, a lot of people say use eggshells for calcium. You're probably not calcium deficient anywhere in the country. If you live in America, you're probably not. You could be, but you're probably not. I don't like grinding up eggshells. Whenever I crack an egg that's going to compost, I take my hand and I just crumble the shit out of it and throw it in the compost. When I do that, and I put that eggshell in the bin with the food, within one or two feedings, it's gone. How exactly it gets broken down, I don't know, and I don't care. I also know if I put a whole, like a half of an eggshell in there, that sumbitch will be there, it seems like forever. I'm sure sooner or later it breaks down. I think it has something to do with the membrane inside the eggshell, that when you crumble them up, the microbes can get at the surface area a little bit better and can take it out. And I've done that with worm compost, regular compost, whatever. When I moved into this place, people that lived here before me, they made a go of it. They tried. They had a pretty decent little compost pile. It looked like a static, continuous ad. And I used it. It was okay. But as I dug down, these people ate the hell out of eggs. They had like 12 kids. It was a dude that was married to like three women. They were fundamental LDS. And they had a bunch of kids. And I guess eggs were cheap, or at least were, and these people must have eaten eggs every day. There were so many eggshells in there, including the ones at the very bottom of the pile still look brand new. But as soon as you crush them, they break down. So that's all I do with eggshell. I often use some mats. This is something I guarantee you, I've never heard anybody talk about this. Mats of string algae. So in my garden ponds, I inevitably get string algae blooms. And I'll just drag a bunch of that out, and I'll get, you know, an area, probably about 20 to 25% is as much as I'll cover, and that might be two pieces of it. And I'll kind of stretch it out and put most of the water out, but it's still damp. And when I feed, I'll feed, and I'll put that on top of it, or it's already there, I'll pull it back and feed underneath it. They love it. They're up in it. They're underneath it. When you have it in there, if there's food here and that there, until the food underneath it runs out, all they want is the food that's underneath it. I think it accelerates the breakdown and it gives them the environment they're looking for. I even take mats of that string algae and I'll put it on top of my ebb and flow beds in my aquaponic systems. And when you pull it up, there's worms all up in there. They come up out of the, it gives them a place when there's the ebb cycle, when the water's coming in, it gives them a place kind of to go and retreat to where they're not exposed. Right, so, I mean, it just is one of the best things. They love it. And it takes a long time to break down and go away. And it, again, it's another micro mineral source. So that's something that you can do. I would not intentionally give yourself a string algae problem to do it. But if you have some garden ponds or something, they're producing string algae or any kind of thing like that, they love that shit. I mean, almost enough that, you know, if you don't, it almost is worth having like one tank that you let it happen to that's not connected to any other tanks for how much they love it. Because, I mean, they really love it. I also feed them small amounts of azolla and duckweed. And by that, I mean, I'm going to go out there to feed them. I walk by one of my ponds. I reach in. I pull up, you know, a small handful, not even a handful, just one scoop of it. Because especially azolla is very high in nitrogen, and it can break down. And you can compost azolla and nothing else. Like, if you have enough azolla, you just put it in a pile and turn it every couple days. And at the end of about 20 days, you'll have perfect compost with no other ingredients. So that tells you how active it is with breaking down. So small amounts of it, but they love the shit out of that too. And it's another feed source, and it's another nutrient input, another mineral input. Now, this is really one of the secrets. Flake fish food. You know, I said you put food in and they don't eat it right away? And they don't. Like, you open it up and there's worms all up under, but it takes a long time for that food to go away. If you put down a pretty good amount of flake fish food and cover it with something like a mat of seaweed or just your top mat or whatever, there'll be almost nothing left of it in one day. And the worms, when you pull that back where that fish food was, they'll be there to the exclusion of everything else. And all I think it is flake fish food has so much surface area, the bacteria and microorganisms just can almost instantly colonize it. And it's really easy for them to eat what's left really fast. And they love it. And it's one of the ways that I explode worm populations in new systems. I'll bet you no one... I thought about saving that little one for a future paid-for course. I bet you've never heard that in your life. And I've done it. I've put in 10 worms in an ebb and flow bed, gotten one little mat of algae, and started putting a handful of fish food under it every couple days on that ebb and flow bed. And in, it seems like no time at all, but probably a month, because there is a life cycle to worm reproduction, the damn thing is riddled with worms. And it is, I can't explain why it works. I can just tell you that it works. Another thing that I do, and I think this is a very good management practice. You know, even something like the Vivor, you're looking at about a 2 foot, I think it's 16, so it's 6 foot and a half square, right? It's a pretty big surface area for the amount of food you're feeding. What people are tempted to do is to think like we're feeding chickens or something where they're all competitive, spread the food out. I like to pull back like a sector, like a quarter of the of your top mulch, put down the food in that sector and cover it back up. And when I go to feed again, I'll pull that back and see if that food is being eaten. And if it hasn't been eaten yet, again, don't feed it. It makes it very easy to like go clockwork around. And, you know, with the amount of time you're feeding, you probably remember last time was the upper right corner. And it just makes it easier to manage and then to be like, well, this looks like they ate it pretty good, but there was a little bit last week. Go back to the older food. Is it gone yet? And it helps you not overfeed. When you spread it out, you can convince yourself that they're eating enough food. But when you concentrate the food in a sector, like 25% of the surface area, and they haven't really eaten it, it's really obvious that you're overfeeding, so you can back off for a while. Again, that's another one that I've never heard anybody say. One I have heard people say is to chop your food up a bit. So if we have like my cucumber that went bad, it just looks nasty, I'll chop it into pieces. I won't just throw the whole thing in there. And if it has a skin on it, I really want to slice it so that the flesh can be colonized more easily. Think about what is the purpose of a skin on a fruit? Because your cucumbers, your tomatoes, and all, they're actually fruits, they're not vegetables. What is the purpose of a skin? You want to know what the purpose is? I can show you real fast. Get yourself a lemon or a lime, and a zester, and zest it. Don't even pull the whole skin off. Just take the zest. Most of it, all of it, whatever you need. Instead of using that lemon or lime, leave it sit on a countertop for a day or two. In a day or two, it'll be as hard as a brick because you've removed the protection that keep the moisture in and things out. So if you're going to put a cucumber in there, at minimum, slice it down the center and put it face down. Get the skin out of the way. But the more you chop it up, I'm not going to do it, but I wouldn't say it was you'd be wrong if you threw it in a food process. More chop, more surface area, more biological colonization, and the worm doesn't eat it. The biology eats it, and the worm eats the byproducts of that process. So that would be another thing you could do. Always keep a carbon barrier on the top. And so, again, I like to use a coca coir mat or something like that, or a hemp mat or something all natural carbon. Layers of paper work too. Cardboard works, whatever you want. But the number one thing that's going to do is keep it from drying out. The number two thing that's going to do is keep fruit flies the hell out of your food. Because fruit flies, you're like ringing the bell. Now, one thing you need to understand is that a lot of times the fruit fly problem that we end up with, the fruit fly egg came on the produce that you bought at the store. So by washing your produce in a mild vinegar solution when you get home, a lot of your fruit fly problems, like if you have them flying around your house every summer or something, it'll make that go away. Because you're bringing, like, where'd they come from? They didn't spontaneously generate in your living room. So that's just a good thing to know as well. But when you're outside and you have rotting fruit, that's the dinner bell. So it takes one pregnant fruit fly to get in there and you have a fruit fly infestation. Last, I welcome roly-polies and springtails. I literally seed, once that bed is starting to establish, that den starts, I'll go out to my garden and I'll pick up a handful of roly-polies and pitch them in there. If I have an area where I know there's some springtails and I see them, I'll just grab a handful of that soil and I'll throw that soil in there. More biology into the system. There's things I don't want in there. I really don't care for black soldier flies in my worm bin. Again, because their process is different. They multiply so fast. And the other thing with BSLs is once they're in something, like it's just screaming for more to come. They put out an odor that's actually designed to keep other insects out of their place. But that odor is like a dinner bell for all the other BSLs to come lay your eggs here. This is good. That's how they locate those systems. But you want to try to, you know, keep certain things out, but roly-polies and springtails, I love them. They don't hurt anything. They love to eat breaking down organic matter. They help accelerate that process. They feed the worms quicker. Roly-polies are one of God's gifts to man, and we need to stop villainizing them. I've talked about that before, but they're not the thing that's eating your broccoli plant. They're not. They're eating the broccoli plant after something else has damaged it. They're eating the damaged, dying, or dead tissue is what they're doing. Now, how do we did all this work. We've done a good job. We've managed our worms. We didn't murder them. We took care of the box. We have this beautiful, dark, good-smelling worm castings, which is worm poop. What do we do with it? One of the easiest things to do, just the plants that you think need some fertility, which is all of them. If there's mulch, pull the mulch back and scatter it around the base of the plant. Pull it back over. That's the easiest thing, and it works beautifully. You can also, like, for deep feeding, like mid-seasoning your peppers and tomatoes, take a couple fingers and dig away from the thing, from the stalk of the plant down a few inches, fill that hole and push it back over, and fill it right there in the root zone of the plant. What works even better and makes it go further, though, is to make tea or extract. And I want to talk about the difference yet again with teas and extracts. I almost make no compost tea at all anymore. Compost tea, we take the compost, in this case worm castings, we put it in a bucket of water. We put in 4 or 5 air stones, and we aerate the shit out of it. 24 to 36 hours, we strain it, and then we apply it as a drench or a foliar feed. And it works. And when we do that, we're also going to add a feed source, a little bit of molasses, some sort of a sugar, maybe some other stuff that feeds our microbiology. And the idea is we're going to explode the population. This works? No, anybody says it doesn't work is ill-informed and you shouldn't listen to them, even if they tell you to make an extract instead, because they don't know what they're talking about. Of course it works, but what does it do? There'll be some small portion of the community of biology in there that really loves the sugar, the air, and the water. Their population will explode at the expense of the others. If we don't do that, we pretty much take the biology as it is with the ratios it has, and we distribute it that way. And to me, that's a much better way to go. It's faster, and there's less that can go wrong. How do you do that? Take a double handful, throw it in a 5-gallon bucket, stir it with your arm, strain it out, wring it out, take the wet material and spread it in your garden, and then take that extract and spray it or soil drench with it. It's a biology thing. Don't dilute it. Don't dilute it. You just dilute it. You don't need to dilute it again. Use it full strength. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. Now, the leachate that will come out of your bin sooner or later, you'll get a little extra water. That should be diluted at about 10 to 1. Use it the same way. It's a great product, but remember, we're not trying to create it on purpose. It is a byproduct of when moisture exceeded the holding capacity of the system. And whenever you get it, don't add any more moisture for a couple of days. Because if you keep doing it, eventually you're going to get anaerobic or kick off thermophilic, and you're going to have problems. You're also going to start getting bad odors, and you're going to be more likely to attract infestations of other insects when you do that, because they don't really want to be in a well-balanced worm bin. They want to be in a dank, stank, nasty thing. Right? And a lot of insect, you know, infestation pests make it more what they want it to be, which is what you don't want it to be. So there's a little add-in there. And then the other thing you can do with it is use it in your other compost. So I usually throw a little bit of worm compost into my bioreactors in the beginning, but not a lot. In fact, last couple of times I've done it, I haven't even bothered. But what I love to do is add it to a bioreactor compost when it is done with the thermophilic. If you're doing a high turn, like a Berkeley method of compost, when you're finished and it looks beautiful, you shouldn't use it. You should age it for at least a month. During that aging process, add some worm compost to it. Increase the biology. It is fantastic to make your other compost even better. When you put that biology in there, you're going to have, what does life do? It finds a way. Right, it multiplies. It makes more of itself. Anyway, now, some other advice. If you don't use it right away, you just harvested a 1-gallon Ziploc bag of castings out of your worm farm. Best course of action, use it this week. Spread it in your garden, put it in your house plants, add it to your other compost pile that's aging. Do whatever you want to do, but use it. That is the best thing, best course of action. But you may want some for later. Get yourself a good bin that has a little bit of breathability in it. Keep an eye on it. Every once in a while, open it up, check it. Do not let it dry out. Keep it cool, keep it dry, keep it moist. Treat it like any other compost that you were aging. If you let it dry out, you've ruined it. You did all this work for nothing. Right? If it gets too hot, you've ruined it. You did all this work for nothing. If it freezes solid, you did all this work for nothing. And of those things, the worst that can happen is drying out. What hydrophobic is, you know you never want it to happen. And I do want to explain what it is for people who have never heard me talk about it before. What happens is the living organisms, as this substance that they live in begins to dry out, it sends off alarm bells. It's like their world is literally ending, and it is. And so they start creating biogels and forming a coating around themselves and therefore around the material that they're in. And this is a survival mechanism. And it's going to create like a cocoon that repels water. They don't want to wake up because there's a little bit of water. They want to wake up for a heroic rain event. This is how they survive in nature. Some of the critters that do this are really long-term survivors. Most are not. It's a short-term survival mechanism. So by the time you hydrate it enough to break that surface tension of those biogels and crack through and rehydrate it, it looks good, but most of the biological diversity is now gone and dead. This is not what we want. We want to treat it like soil, not dirt. Moving on, this is why most of what you buy in stores is 100% total garbage. Not when it was made, but by the time you get it. So I'm, you know, Bill Worm's Worm Factory. And I make worm compost. And I do it in the big, long, giant rows on my farm in the tree lines. And I use my own product. It's fantastic. I make extracts, and I use it directly, and it's beautiful. You would think, well, that's a great guy to buy from. Not if it's coming out of Lowe's with his label on it. He does a great job. He does everything right. And then he packages it into bags. The bags go on a pallet. The pallet goes to a warehouse. It sits in the warehouse until XYZ store orders it. A forklift sticks it in the back of a semi. It is not a climate-controlled semi, is it? Nor was the warehouse it was in. It's treated like dirt or rocks. No one cares. It dries out. It goes hydrophobic. It has massive temperature swings, and it's sealed in a bag, and Bill really wants it to get to you moist, not completely dried out. So it's sealed in a plastic bag where there's no air exchange. So either it takes a really, really long time, and in spite of that, it dries out, or it takes a long time, and it runs out. All the critters in there live on oxygen. How long would you live inside a sealed-up plastic bag? Yeah, think about a bedroom for scale. I put you in a bedroom and I completely seal it up for a couple of hours. Nothing's wrong. But as the CO2 level climbs and the oxygen level declines, eventually you go to sleep and never wake up. Why would you think an oxygen-using microbe would be any different? So by the time you get this product, unless you know when it was harvested, how it was harvested, how it was sent to you, it's shit. It's literally dried worm shit, and there's no biological activity in it. It's a very mild NPK fertilizer. It's organic matter. It's good for soil tilth. It's not horrible, but it's not what you thought you were getting. You might as well just throw peat moss in the damn soil at that point. Really, that is not what you are looking for. So if you want to buy this, find a local supplier that you can rely on that harvests it this week and sells it to you this week, and you use it this week or next week. If you're not doing that, you're not getting really worm castings. You're getting dried out worm shit. They're not the same thing. Okay. Now, remember, anyone can do this. It deals with your waste, and it produces black gold. This is why you should consider doing it. Because you can. A person in an apartment, one-bedroom apartment, can do this. You have some waste stream that somebody else is dealing with. You can flip that on its head so that you're dealing with it. And you can then take that product. You can use it even on a patio balcony. And the amount you can make with one worm farm will do everything you could ever want it to do with like a container garden on your patio. To the point where you will be giving it away. And any gardener will love you for this. Any gardener, any person with a little farm or something like that, you give somebody like that a bag of freshly harvested this week worm castings, you just gave them a big old sloppy kiss as far as they're concerned. I mean, like, you just gave them a gift, right? I mean, like, really. It is something that is so valuable to our ecosystems, to our gardens, to our orchards. There isn't really much that's better. I would say bioreactor compost is better, and it's a form of worm composting, just done on a different scale in a different way. I would put it as the number two best compost product on the planet is fresh worm castings. Number one, bioreactor. Number three, a well-made, high-turn, like chicken tractor on steroids compost. Like one, two, three right there, and they're all wonderful. But the other two require space, quantity, etc. It rules out a lot of things. Anybody can do this. And so I really recommend that you consider doing it. On that note, item of the day today fits perfectly. It's the Vivor 5-tray worm composter. And I want to tell you something about this. When I sent out the social media stuff today and when I sent out the email later today, one of the things I'll say is, how would you like to get a $100 composter for $60? That's what you get with this. Since I talk a lot about making worm compost and all, I don't need to rehash that here for the item of the day segment. I'm just going to tell you something about this composter that I really love. There's a composter that if you go to the worm composting forums and groups and stuff like that, that people love, at least if they're not DIY purists. And it's called the Vermahut. And it's $100. And it's been around for a long time. Vivor's composter is a private label version of the Vermahut for $60 instead of $100. It is the same product. It is not a clone. It is the same exact product. It is made on the same molds, in the same factory, by the same company. How do I know this? One, because it 100% match. It's not close. Even the accessories are identical. But I read instruction manuals when I review a product. I read them cover to cover, no matter how much Chinglish is in them, no matter what, no matter how boring they are. I don't read the French part if they're in multi-language or whatever, because I don't speak French or Chinese. I don't reread it in Spanish, even though I'm okay in Spanish. But I read the English part, every word. Well, when I was like, this thing seems a lot like the Vermahut to me. And if you look up my write-up, there's a page I took a picture of it. When they did the documentation to bring it over as a private label product, somebody missed the word Vermahut in one paragraph. It refers to it in the documentation as the Vermahut. It's the same product for $40 less. You can buy two of them for $120 or one Vermahut for $100 and do that two side-by-side comparison that I was mentioning. So I really recommend that you check this thing out. And let's go ahead and do some Q&A here. Andy says, adjacent question, what's the easiest way to gather worms from a field without digging them up or damaging my lawn? Well, I can tell you how we used to do it as a kid for fishing bait. We knew where lots of worms were around the garden. And I would go out at night after a rainstorm with a red-capped flashlight. And don't shine the light straight down. Shine it kind of out and across them. And then you got to grab them before they go back down in their burrow and pull really slow. And that way you usually get night crawlers. Another way would be to create a happy worm environment. Find a place with exposed dirt where you expect worm population is pretty good. Lay down some food and put down some sort of a wet mat. Go out there in the dark with your flashlight and get as many as you can before they go back down in the ground. But I am not sure that, you know, not digging is the best way to go in most situations. It all depends. The other thing is most of the worms that you're going to find doing that are night crawlers. And there's nothing wrong with night crawlers. But if you want red wigglers, you're probably more likely to find them in like a compost situation. That's the environment that they prefer. So good quality compost, you will generally find worms in your compost. And those are great worms to get. And again, by seeding your bin with those, you'll do even better long term. Next, your builder of castles says, Dr. Worms B-Deed pesticides, great for all your worm bins. Don't know what that is. I think he's making a joke based on the smiley face. And again, with one eye, if it has a capital, I'd put it up. David says, what is your opinion regarding in-ground bins? I've seen a number of bins that look like a laundry basket buried in between rows of guards. I've talked about that, so I'll just let that go. They work, but you're not likely to be able to get the product out of them the way that we do. They're more about a passive system, and I think they work really well for what they do. Would you add biochar? We talked about that. I add biochar every time I feed. I've really gotten four worm bins on board with feeding pelletized biochar. So I have the Blue Sky biochar little stove, the fab stove, and you can make biochar out of it using softwood pellets, which are really cheap. And I don't really worry about crushing those very much at all. I throw them in a Ziploc bag and beat them with a rubber mallet just so they're broken up a little bit. By the time you are harvesting your castings, those things are just broken down. I mean, when you think about it, they're a wood pellet. You turn them into charcoal. They're still a pellet. They're still compressed little pieces. What happens to a wood pellet when it gets wet? It explodes and goes to dust. So I've been using those a lot and using my more conventionally made biochar, you know, straight into my bigger composting systems and all. Brent Jacobson says, not sure if you mentioned it, but how do you deal with mites? My bin is full of them. If you follow the practices that we did today, which includes keeping that surface covered with a carbon source, you'll have less of them. There's probably some people that, you know, that might be something to ask in our Telegram group or something. Since I haven't had a big problem with, you know, fungus gnats, and it's probably fungus gnats that you're dealing with, not mites, but it could be mites. There's probably other ways to deal with it. I'm really reluctant to say something like DE because I have a feeling DE can nuke your worms. So I'm really not sure on that one. If anybody has something quick before we close up here in the next couple minutes on dealing with gnats or mites in a worm bin, go ahead and post that real quick, and I'll hit it after these next two questions. Dante says, do you create your own rock dust? If so, how? No, bro. No. Grinding rock into dust, that's an industrial process, and rock dust is cheap. You know, azomite, green sand, granite dust, there's tons of that shit available. It's a product that's very inexpensive relative to how much you use. You know, a tablespoon of rock dust is a massive amount of mineral. And I like, again, spreading it each time you feed, whether it's kelp meal, green sand, rock dust, whatever. It's one of the three. Each time you feed, you end up with a really uniform dispersal of it. Plus, you end up with it processed through the gut of the worm. But I am not, no. No, I'm not making big ones out of little ones. That's what they do to you when you go to prison. You have to make big rocks and little rocks. Mitchell said, did you receive that IMO package? I did. I got it Saturday. I know you told me to open it right away, but I didn't. It looks like somebody kicked the shit out of it, and it would really be a great idea, Mitchell. I appreciate you sending it to me. If you would send me an email today and tell me what to do with it, because I am going to go open it up today, but it was soaking wet, and it looked like the post office hated the fact that it existed. And so I appreciate that you sent it to me, but I have not had time to deal with it, and I don't know what I'm going to deal with when I open it. It does not look good. And again, I thank you for it. You're not the post office. You didn't do it. But, I mean, again, if you tell me what to do with it, I'll try to still use it, but I'm not really sure. Mitchell does say when it comes, I think he's talking about the worm bin gnat problem, try spraying lactic acid or adding Bokashi brand houseplants have gotten gnats react well to it. So that may work really well. I always thought Bokashi and worm bins didn't mix, but when I looked into it a few weeks ago, there's a lot of people that feed Bokashi into their worm bins and they have no problems with it at all. I always thought since it was a lactic pickling that the acidity might be not good for worms, but again, plenty of people do it. So maybe a little bit of a lab, so a lactoacid bacillus that you make with like rice or a byproduct of cheese making or whatever might be a good gnat control. And I uses a little bit of a mist on the surface. I can't see that really hurting your worms at all. I really can't. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Again, check out that Vivor worm bin, guys. $60, that thing is a deal. I would much rather, for something like this, especially if you're new to this and you want to get started with it, have a purpose-built product for what you're doing. And it's because the product is one variable, you are the other. And when you have a purpose-built product, you don't have to worry about the product, you only have to worry about your management practices. Bad Computer says, I add Bokashi to a soil digester before feeding it to the worms. That's cool. Wild Blue Whippet says, dealing with gnats, maybe the sticky things we stick on our houseplants will work. The gnats land on them and are stuck. As long as they don't get down where the worms get on them. One thing you know about worms, worms explore. Worms explore. So even that mat you put down, sometimes you'll find a worm like up the side or whatever, but you're not going to lose all your worms that way. But some type of thing like that might be beneficial as well. But I don't know, a light misting of a diluted lab fluid, liquid, I'm trying to, culture, that's what I was saying. Couldn't get the word, diluted lab culture, again, when I say lab, for those not familiar, I mean lactoacid bacteria, just missed it across the top. I actually have had some issues with like fungus gnats and stuff like that on one of my indoor aquaponic systems. I may try that just for the see what it does. And I would definitely risk trying it on one of my worm beds if I had an infestation. I've never had really a problem with it. Anyway, guys, hope you guys enjoyed today. Tomorrow we'll have another episode. Wednesday, I ain't decided exactly what we're going to do yet, if I'm going to do a live stream. But I do not have an interview because I'm out of here very early Thursday. I'm going to try to do the Expert Council show early for you and get it up, pre-published, and ready to go. So it just goes out on its own on Thursday automatically, and try not to do a rewind. We will have a Friday flashback. So I hope this will be pretty much a normal week other than no interview. I am not sure what I want to do a show on tomorrow. If you have any ideas, shoot me an email. Tell me something you want me to do a show on. Jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. As always, TSPC, like it's a word, TSPC in the subject line, followed by question for Jack or whatever. That'll make sure that I actually see it. And if somebody sends me a cool idea, maybe I'll do a show on it tomorrow. One way or another, we'll have something. Take care, guys. Thanks for tuning in and joining me in a live stream.
Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.